Hello, everybody. Dave Hodges here, host of the Common Sense Show. We are the show that's freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for sharing what we do. We don't get a lot of recommendations on our social media, and I don't mean from the audience. I mean from the system. So I'm asking you, please share, because this is an important show. You've heard me talk a lot about the similarities between the JFK assassination and Charlie Kirk, and I've made brief references to Vince Foster, although we did a whole show on Vince Foster. Very good show, very well received. We're going to tie it all together here because it's the same MO every time. And it's exactly what my intel officer father said about RFK, JFK, and MLK. Said the same things I think we're going to hear a lot of today. We're coming to you from the Noble Gold Studios, and Noble Gold is where you want to be. There is, what, almost 70 banks on the watch list now for the Federal Reserve. Private equity is failing. The banks are in trouble. And the laws favor them. Dodd-Frank 2010, UCC Code Section 8 says they can keep your money. More than likely, they'll bail you out, but you'll lose a high percentage of what you save. Don't have a retirement associated with the bank ever. Who can fix all of this for you? It's the same company I've been using for 9 years, Noble Gold. I'll just give out the number and trust that you're going to do the rest because you're going to do what's in your best interest. 877-646-5347. Again, call 877-646-5347. And if you forget the number, just go to noblegoldinvestments.com and they will never pressure you. Well, John Clark is an expert on Vince Foster. We've heard that before, but now we're going to tie together three major assassinations. I can't wait to hear the words of someone who's really studied this thoroughly and see if our conclusions match. And I always stand ready to be corrected where I've been wrong. John, thanks so much for joining us. And we overcame some communication issues, but we're here, good to go. Glad to have you. Let's get down to business here. You know, let me just start off with a bold statement here. When you see the similarities of the MO between these different assassinations, it means one of two things. Either the same people are involved or they're just adopting the same game plan that's worked before.
Well, to me, what occurs to me in all three of those cases is the laws of physics, which I call God's laws. You cannot overcome them. And we see in the JFK, the magic bullet. No, it didn't happen the way the government said. And same thing with the Charlie Kirk. We saw that at least my understanding is that his that 30-06 is not the death weapon, was not the murder weapon, because if it were, it would have blown. There'd be an exit wound and there would be a bloody mess, and there wasn't. So again, it's the laws of physics that tell us that when the government has a theory that violates the laws of physics, it's just not true.
Yeah, that's true. You look at this, and I will talk about motives maybe possibly at the end, but I totally agree with you. 30-06 is a joke. And I would add to this too, if it wasn't a cover-up, then why would you cover up the crime scene 48 hours later when there still should have been a forensic investigation going on in the immediate area?
Yeah, I agree. They did that with Martin Luther King. They changed the crime scene, and they did that with the Vince Foster matter also. They quite a bit of changing of the topography of the park.
Yeah,
where, well, Vince Foster was found in Fort Marcy Park.
Yeah, let me digress just for a moment, but it's kind of on point. Your background as an attorney, if you were trying the case as a defense attorney for Tyler Robinson, haven't they given you enough to create a lot of reasonable doubt that a jury might not convict?
I would think so. And my understanding is that neither the prosecutor nor the defense attorneys have reached out to Candace Owens or anyone else who has been really taking this case apart. And I find that a bit troubling.
Yeah, I would do that too. I'd say, okay, what do you think we're missing here? Just to cover your bases, if nothing else. I totally agree with you. But you know what's interesting? I don't know if you've come across this. There's chicanery in the prosecution team against Tyler Robinson. A first cousin to the Farnsworth family that has deep ties to TPUSA, including Terrell Farnsworth, the guy that disassembled the video camera on scene, just as Charlie fell. He didn't go to Charlie, he went to the camera. Well, that's the family line in TPUSA and their first cousins on the prosecution team. As an attorney, would you find that to be a problem?
I would find that to be a problem. Yes, that sounds like a conflict of interest to me.
Huge. And there's one too on the defense team. It's not as strong, but they had a family member at the scene. I don't know that that's disqualifying, but there's all these anomalies. Did you find this to be true? I'm trying to confirm this, that in Utah, when someone's declared to be indigent and can't afford an attorney, the prosecution chooses the defense team. Is that true? Do you know?
I don't know if that's true. That does not sound right to me.
Does
Certainly, right. All defendants are entitled to counsel, whether they can afford it or not. I don't know if, in fact, the prosecution team selected these counsel for Tyler Robinson. Do you know whether or not that is the case?
That's been
I have
reported,
heard that.
but I've had it, heard it reported multiple times, but that doesn't mean it's true. And that's why I was asking you if you had knowledge of this. But here's one thing that bothered me. The justification I've heard for doing this, if it's true, here's the justification. And this comes out of the mainstream media. Well, the judge get or the prosecution gets to pick the defense team, and usually it's the defense, the prosecution picks the defense team in an indigent case. But here's the problem with that. I know firsthand of attorneys who wanted to represent Tyler Robinson pro bono, and they weren't even considered. Doesn't the defendant have the right to know who's trying to reach him to defend him and have the final determination to choose a qualified attorney?
Absolutely. The defendant gets to choose who represents him. And if he's not satisfied, as a general proposition, he can fire him and get somebody else.
Yeah, it just seems like it's such a slam dunk in this trial. It's absolutely amazing. Well, what other similarities do you find? Let's take JFK for a second. You mentioned the magic bullet. Anything else jumps out at you that kind of reminds you of the Charlie Kirk situation?
Yeah, the news media, I think, is sort of in the same modus operandi. Let me tell you a brief story about Patrick Knowlton. When in 1997, when the three-judge Court of Appeals panel ordered Kenneth Starr to attach 20 pages that I authored to the independent counsel report, that was an historic event. What we have is the highest ranking official to be murdered since JFK, the report of the independent counsel, and actually that was Brett Kavanaugh's report, ordered attached to the independent counsel's report, and nobody reported it. Patrick and I went to go see Pete Yost of the Associated Press, and I showed it to him, and I explained to him, how momentous it was and how, what was going on here. And he hemmed and hawed, said, "I don't know if I'm going to cover that," et cetera, et cetera. And so I said, "Pete, you don't understand. This is evidence of murder cover-up, actual evidence attached to the ordered attached to the independent counsel's report." Of the highest ranking official of the murder since JFK. And Pete said, "No, you don't understand. The story has already been written. It's already in the can. The story is he was depressed and he committed suicide." So it's absolutely astounding that not one of those, no media, period, in the United States reported that. We call that the Great Suppression of 97.
Wow, that's amazing. But it's a lot like this too. If we raise questions on Charlie Kirk today, and TPUSA should be leading the charge in this, one of their own was murdered, and the investigation is horse crap for reasons we can get into. But I look at this and I'm saying, when I raise questions, what TPUSA is doing is they're sending out cease and desist letters. They don't want to know the truth. And then you have Joe Rogan, who went to, who was it? Kash Patel, and he took Tulsi Gabbard with him, and Susie Wiles was there as well, chief of staff. And he asked for more FBI evidence on foreign involvement in the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and he was told no. It stops here. I mean, it's the same thing, isn't it? It's like Dallas, Texas. You know, the Warren Commission didn't interview the doctors that worked on Kennedy from the hospital. I mean, it's the same crap over and over.
Yeah, and hopefully this time they won't get away with it with the advent of social media
Yeah,
and
exactly.
alternative media.
That is a great point. I've said this often. If JFK had been assassinated in the modern era right now, no one would have believed the official story within about 3 days.
I think that's absolutely correct.
Yeah, it is shocking. Why do you think they keep using the same game plan? Because most of the country knows the government's full of crap about Kennedy. The ones who know about Vince Foster don't believe the official story. And overwhelmingly, people aren't believing the Charlie Kirk story.
So, what is your question about those items?
Well, why do you think that they keep promoting these common narratives that people disbelieve? Are they so arrogant they just don't care what the public thinks?
I think that's part of it. And they're, they at least up until now, they have held all the communications. Again, that story about Vince Foster and the three-judge Court of Appeals panel. That's nobody knows about that, except perhaps some people who will watch your show that we talked about that both
Exactly.
today and the last time I was on.
Yeah. Well, John, when you were on before, I had not heard of that. And I thought I knew a little bit about Vince Foster, but I didn't know that. So you're right. That's not common knowledge.
Yeah, and that three that appendix has got, as I said, five areas of a cover-up, and I can go through them if we have time very briefly. This is this I know you can see this, and again you can go to vincefostermurder.com. It's there. Now this is a the exhibit an exhibit the third exhibit showing that they tricked Mrs. Foster into identifying the weapon because they showed her a silver gun, which by all accounts he did own. And we can see from this photograph the gun that was re ultimately recovered. It was a drop gun, ultimately recovered from his hand was silver, was black. And then
Remember this.
the next report, the next exhibit shows that his car was not in the parking lot. And the next exhibit shows that there was a bullet wound in his neck. And not in his mouth, as the government reported. And then the next exhibit shows that that 13 photographs have disappeared, were buried, and that a entire roll of 35 millimeters film disagree vanished. The final one shows that the autopsy was that the X-ray machine was functioning properly, but there were at least the official version is that no X-rays were taken because the the machine was malfunctioning. So I mean, it just goes. It could not be more obvious. And one more thing, that I didn't get an opportunity to chat with you about the last time, is that we know from the forensic evidence that, and I could show this to you. It's in this lengthy volume critique, and I'm assuming you can see
I can see it.
that.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and that shows the powder debris on Vince Foster's hand that was here and here. So we
Yeah.
have
Can I
powder
describe
debris.
that? Because some people will hear this only audio. You're describing powder burns that run across the edge of the hand on the upper side.
Yes, from the index finger
Okay.
down into the thumb, on both sides, on both of his hands.
Okay.
That shows that he could not have pulled the trigger. The official version is that he pushed the trigger with his thumb, but no, he could not do that. We know from that gunshot residue that this is what the when the shot was fired, that this is what is going on here. And for those of you who cannot see this, he's
Yeah.
pushing the weapon away from his neck. So It's not unusual
Oh.
for him, for a powder to be like that when somebody pushes the trigger with his thumb. It's impossible. And of course, there were no fingerprints on the weapon. 90-some degree heat on a July day in Washington, D.C. The whole thing is just so absurd.
No, I hear you. But you know what you're reminding me of, too, is that all the other evidence about the Kennedy assassination after finding, like Steve Revelle found the paymaster, my friend, the late Jim Mars interviewed as well. And the guy who got the contract for the Corsican Mafia originally, Christian David, they all said the same thing. Kennedy was shot with an exploding bullet, okay, a hollow point bullet. Okay, well, that doesn't match Oswald's gun. So here's what they did in the autopsy, and this sounds just like what you're describing with Vince Foster. They lost the brain. How do you lose the brain in the most important autopsy in the 20th century? But they lost the brain. That's not in dispute. That, you know,
well, in the Foster matter, Dr. James Beyer removed the brain before the police arrived at the autopsy.
Oh, no.
He removed it.
You didn't tell me that before.
And he also removed. Yeah, the autopsy was over by the time the police arrived to witness it. He also removed the soft palate, which is allegedly where the entrance wound was, but of course it was not. And Dr. Beyer said that he could. There was so much gunpowder or gunshot residue on the soft palate that it was that he could see it with the naked eye. And so he took slides and he sent it to the laboratory, and the laboratory could not find a trace of it. None of it. You know, I mean, it's just so obvious. It's just so clear. The government has nothing.
John, I want to say this for the benefit of the audience. When you do an autopsy on a headshot, what you do is you open the head up and you excise the brain. You soak it in formaldehyde so you can do bullet etchings and find what's left in there, fragments you can ballistically match, you know, to the bullet and the gun. And with Kennedy, they couldn't do that because as the Parkland doctor said, the quarter of his cerebellum in the back of his head was blown out, meaning he was not shot from behind there. But they lost the brain. But taking the brain out prior to the autopsy, people soaking in formaldehyde, these people wouldn't make it to the midterm exam in their education courses if they did that.
Yeah, in the Foster case, Dr. Beyer said that he put the brain on essentially a meat slicer and sliced it up to see whether or not he could find any bullet fragments. So, you know, and again, this was before the police arrived to witness the autopsy.
Let's go to Charlie Kirk for a second. I have some statements that have been made publicly that I have problems with, but I'm not convinced there's an autopsy that we can get our hands on and see. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know that it has not been released.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know if it ever will be released. I just don't know.
Well, I'm going to give you something that is up your alley as an attorney. Okay, you've got Andrew Colvid, the head of communications for TPUSA, for their PR part of the firm. He said that Dr. Trotter, okay, a guy in the emergency room when they received Charlie's body, Dr. Trotter told him Charlie had a neck like Superman and it stopped the 30-06 and that's why there wasn't an exit wound. Here's the legal concern I have. First of all, I think that's a nonsense story. But the legal concern, and I want to see if you agree with this, is that Dr. Trotter violated HIPAA. Andrew Colvitt's not a family member.
I think that is in all likelihood correct. I think that's right.
So then Andrew Colvitt is lying, or Dr. Trotter should face discipline. I mean, this you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, and again, I don't think we're going to see that autopsy report. Once again, it defies the rules of physics.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you something highly controversial, but I've heard the tape. A person kind of like me, Baron Coleman, who does a lot of, he got a hold of police dispatch. Now, you know, they piled Charlie's body into an SUV, which is a big problem for me to begin with. Where's the ambulance? Why aren't you going to the nearest hospital? They didn't do any of those things. But going down the highway, a police officer calls into dispatch and Barron's played the tape. And his credibility is on the line, and he's also an attorney. So he's not going to come out here and lie. He doesn't want to face discipline. And he plays the tape where the cop is saying, the door is open of the SUV that matches the description that took Charlie's body to the hospital, and someone's trying to get out. And then we don't hear the rest of it. It's redacted. Does that kind of catch you by surprise?
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought that was pretty amazing, pretty telling.
Did you find that to be? I found Barron's report on that to be credible, the way he went about it.
Yeah, I think he's very credible. He's doing a great job.
The public should be inflamed about this. Have you looked at the motives too? We talked about the Vince Foster motive before, and it's really nebulous. But with JFK and Charlie, do you find any commonality in motives that would lead to an executive action like that?
Well, I don't know. There are, theories about why that was, and getting for Kennedy a nuclear capability being given to Israel. Kennedy was against that, and after he was shot, murdered, Israel got neutral capability. So, that's certainly a potential motive.
I know this story. I know how Israel got it. And this is pretty well documented. Robert Maxwell, Mossad, okay? He's revered by the Mossad. He's in a special burial place in Israel. He made it, let's put it this way. Someone had to have made the plans available to him that he gave to Israel on how to build nukes. And what's interesting, do you know who his daughter is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ghislaine
Maxwell is that getting interesting? And no wonder we can't talk about the Epstein files. So there is an Israeli possible motive, and you agree with me on that, with Charlie, who wanted to turn away from Israel and not attack Iran.
I think that's clear. Yes.
I think
absolutely.
It is too. And then you got JFK. And, you know, I never considered the nuclear issue with JFK until the Charlie Kirk thing happened. I didn't realize how significant this was, and I had to go look into it. But I do agree with you. Any possibility Vince Foster could have fallen prey to an Israeli interest?
I suppose that there is that possibility. Again, as we talked to the last time, I just don't know. But if we have time, I'd like to chat with you about the meeting that I had with Brett Kavanaugh.
Okay.
If that's all right.
Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He, from your listeners who saw the previous program, Miguel Rodriguez was not willing to go along with the cover up. We have him on tape talking all about it. So Ken Starr ran him out of the office and appointed Brett Kavanaugh to take over the investigation. So Patrick was a newspaper article, Patrick Nolan, a newspaper article appeared criticizing Ken Starr for not having interviewed Nolan, and said that the FBI had lied repeatedly in his FBI 302 interview reports. So when that happened, Brett Kavanaugh prepared a subpoena and held it for 2 days without serving it. And then when he did serve it, Patrick was harassed on the streets of Washington, D.C. And let me show you, for those of who didn't see that, this is 25 men. This is a map of 25 men who harassed Patrick over the course of 2 days.
Because he wouldn't recant his testimony, correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So, because he continued to tell the truth. So I was involved in the case, got involved on a Friday. The harassment started on Thursday. I got involved on a Friday. And then he testified before the grand jury, questioned by Brett Kavanaugh, and just horribly. We don't have time, I don't think, to go into that. But in any event, Patrick called me. This was on a Wednesday when he testified. And on Friday, he was in his apartment building, and he was at the front desk chatting with the front desk clerk. And he noticed somebody outside in the front pacing back and forth, and he thought that was a little bit strange. I mean, again, this is on the heel of a significant harassment that he had suffered. So, and then this guy who was out in front walked in behind somebody who had a key fob. And as soon as he saw Patrick, he became startled and turned around and left the building right away. And then he was, so Patrick thought, well, you know, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to go out and confront the guy. So he walked out in front of the building, and Patrick, the guy was walking away, and he turned. And as he turned, this is the man, as he turned, he reached into his bag. And Patrick doesn't know what, of course, we don't know what he was reaching for. It might have been a gun or it might not have. But in any event, when he saw Patrick, dropped whatever he was retrieving from his bag and turned and ran. So I called Brett Kavanaugh. It's the second conversation I had with him. I talked to him before Patrick testified before the grand jury. And by this time, I was a little bit angry. After what Patrick had gone through, this guy coming into the building and acting the way he did, I said to Kavanaugh, I explained to him what happened. I said that there was somebody who came into Patrick's building and was either there to scare him or to kill him. And that I wanted a meeting with the FBI and the OIC, that's the Office of Independent Counsel, today. This was at 3:30 in the afternoon. So Kavanaugh said, okay, how about 6 o'clock? So at 6 o'clock, I showed up. I was escorted to a very small conference room with five people in it. Directly across from me was Eric Lukenhoff. He was the supervisory agent in charge. To his left, so to my right, was Deputy Independent Counsel John Bates, who is now a U.S. District Court judge in the District of Columbia. To my left was at the table was a FBI, retired FBI agent who had been assigned to the probe, Coy Copeland. And against the wall, not at the table, was D.C. Homicide Detective Jeff Green. And right to my left was FBI agent Jim Clementi. And Clementi is a profiler, FBI profiler, retired now. You might see him on his YouTube channel, investigating serial, violent, and sexual crimes, which is kind of interesting that he was involved in that probe. But anyway, to Lukenhoff's right, so to my left, was Brett Kavanaugh sitting against the wall. And during the course of the 1 hour meeting, I was complaining to the group about Patrick's treatment before the grand jury and went through what it was that happened just now, asked for protection, and which was refused. And back and forth we went. And the whole time, Brett Kavanaugh was against the wall. He did not say one single word. But if you saw him testify before the Congress when he was being confirmed for a Supreme Court justice, you know that he kind of wears what he feels on his shirt sleeve. I mean, he was almost crying during the course of that hearing, and during the course of this almost hour long meeting, you could see it was written all over his face. He was hemming and hawing. He didn't say a word, but he was just a mess regarding what has gone on here. So, if I ever got him on the stand, I could rip him to shreds and he would not do well. So in any event, that was my meeting, the second time I met with Brett Kavanaugh. And, again, he was put in charge because Miguel Rodriguez would not go along with it. And we have tapes that are at vincefostermurder.com of surreptitiously taped telephone conversations with both Miguel Rodriguez talking all about the cover up and also with Brett Kavanaugh. And Brett was asked by the chairman of Accuracy and Media, Reed Irvine, and he wouldn't let go. What evidence do you have that that Foster's car was in the park? And Reed did not let up on this. He kept on hammering away. And finally, Kavanaugh admitted that everyone in the park, that is over 20 people, all described this Arkansas Honda as brown. Now, Vince Foster's car was
so
silver.
A car.
Yeah, it was a different car. So, and at the end of the conversation, there were two of them, and the taped. And the end of the second one, Brett said to Reed, "You don't tape these conversations, do you, Reed?" And so Reed kind of said, "Yes, I do." And so that was the last conversation that Brett had with Reed Irvine. And the reason that Brett could even talk to Reed was because after the report was issued with the attachment ordered attachment to it, with all this evidence of murder cover-up, Brett took a leave of absence. He was no longer with the Office of Independent Counsel. He was working for a law firm. And so then after it blew over and nobody reported what happened with the independent counsel's report, Brett came back to the Office of Independent Counsel.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to make a parallel here. So Brett Kavanaugh is removed until the smoke clears, and then he gets to do what he wants to do. That's really clear from what you're saying. I look at Joe Kent in the same way, but he resisted. Joe Kent wanted evidence. He wasn't given evidence. He wanted justice. He wasn't given justice. And I'm talking about the Charlie Kirk murder. And then Joe Kent said, fine, I don't like the war. I don't like this and that. I see Israel as a common thread in both cases. And now Joe Kent did what Kavanaugh didn't have the guts to do. He walked away and went public.
That is correct. But Joe Kent has alternative media. He could turn to that. Brett didn't have that.
That's true.
And Miguel Rodriguez spoke with over 100 journalists trying to get the truth out, and he could not do it. Over 100. He spent 6 hours on the phone with Steve Levitan of the New York Times. So he tried. He did his best. Now, if Brett had decided he was not going to go along with the cover-up, he would have had the same. He wouldn't be Supreme Court justice now. He wouldn't have been confirmed to be a U.S. Court of Appeals judge for the D.C. Circuit. His career would have been over.
Yeah, he showed he could keep a secret. And I look at Joe Kent, and I made this statement the other day on my show. I said, if Joe Kent issue with what happened with Charlie had happened in the Biden administration, Fox News would have had him on every single day. Okay. But because it doesn't fit the narrative of the current administration, they're vilifying him. And so you're right about the mainstream media and Brett Kavanaugh. You're absolutely correct. And fortunately, Joe Kent can go to Tucker Carlson, who's no longer mainstream media, and get his story out. So you're absolutely correct on that point. No wonder they want to do away with the mainstream media. Yeah. I don't know if you know this or not. It's not blatant censorship, but it's censorship by default. And here's what I mean. We have a tape and it's gone wild. And you got Netanyahu talking to alternative media people like Laura Loomer and that ilk. Okay. And he says, for all your pro-Israel stories that debunk our critics, we'll pay you between $7,000 and $11,000. Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with that, yes.
Yeah, and see, that's their Israel's attempt to get into the alternative media because they don't fully control it. Where they do, they're able to keep stories out of the mainstream media. It's interesting how the times have changed. Are you concerned that there will be legislation against alternative media coming?
I don't think they could get away with that. They can purchase alternative media and bribe people to toe the government line. But, we still have a First Amendment. I don't think they could get away with that.
Okay. I hope you're right. But I will tell you, this happened, about 10 days ago. The FCC director came out. And he said, if you write misinformation about the war, we're going to keep you from broadcasting. I thought, whoa, who decides what misinformation is? This is blatant censorship right out of the FCC. But I think he only has authority over mainstream broadcasting.
Yeah, no, I did see that. But again, I don't think that, they would certainly like to do that. I don't know that they can regulate what goes over the airwaves. I just don't see how they can do that.
I hope you're right. I just, like I said, I'm getting very, very concerned about where this is headed. I mean, with social media, we had big censorship during the Biden years, and we know the Biden connections with it through the House Oversight Committee. So that is a real big concern I have. I want to ask you a legal question too, and I know I'm not giving you as many details as I'd like to because I don't have them. But let's recreate Charlie Kirk for a second. He goes down in a heap, and immediately Terrell Farnsworth jumps over these chairs and disassembles the cameras and takes the SIM cards out. Okay. I've gotten two answers on this. One, it's clear obstruction of justice. Two, it's not obstruction of justice if the police hadn't gotten command of the crime scene. Where's your position on that?
I don't know whether that would be obstruction of justice or not. I think it depends on what he does with the SIM card, whether or not, of course, if he turns it over to law enforcement, it would not be obstruction of justice. But I don't have a clear answer to your question.
And then I want an opinion question because coming up in April, I forget the date, it's like the 17th, Judge Graf is going to make a determination whether the trial is going to be in secret or they're going to let selected media members cover it, which you know who's going to get to go in and who isn't. But what do you think is going to happen on that ruling? If you were to make a prediction based on what you know.
That's a very good question. I certainly hope that he opens it up to media. I really hope so, but I don't know what whether or not he's going to do that. It's at his discretion. I do know that as to whether or not he wants to do that. But whether he does it or not, there's no way that he can keep the transcripts of what happens inside that courtroom secret. That we're going to see that, and that is a trial that I am very interested. That's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that one.
Yeah, it's going to be a clown show, I think. But here's the other thing that tremendously bothers me. Do you know who Ryan Mata is?
I do not.
Okay. Ryan Mata does kind of a mini version of what I do. No insult to him, but he's not on all the venues I'm on. He's only on X as far as I know. But what Ryan did is he went in and grabbed IP searches of key people. Dr. Trotter from the hospital. Deidre Amari, the chief medical officer of Utah, Judge Graf before he got appointed into the position he's in now, and Tyler Robinson. These were people that were searched by IP addresses from Israel. Do you find that interesting?
I find that very interesting, and I am aware of that. Yeah, I think that was pretty interesting.
And in other words, it speaks to
Before
a
the
plot.
murder.
I'm sorry.
Before the murder, the searches were
Yeah,
conducted.
the first ones were in July, and then they're scrubbed, but Ryan was smart enough to do a photocopy of it. And then the night, this is really interesting. Out of Tel Aviv and Huntsville, Alabama, regional headquarters for FBI, two searches on September 9th, the night before the event. Tyler Robinson, Tyler James Robinson. And I didn't know his middle name until I read this report from Ryan. That to me was shocking that that happened.
Yeah, that was pretty telling. I think there is one more thing that I didn't get an opportunity to talk about at your last the last time you were nice enough to interview me, and that is the conclusion that I wrote in this 500-page report. And as I said in the previous interview, it looks intimidating, 500 pages, but there are 14 chapters, and 11 of them have summaries at the beginning. So it's pretty easy to really to get through or to thumb through to find out what's going on. But in the conclusion, I had said that what we need to do to clear this up is to reenact the Ethics in Government Act. Now, that is the independent counsel statute, and probably most of you reviewers are unaware of this, but we no longer have an independent counsel statute. It had a 5-year sunset, and it was not renewed. And among others who testified against it was Ken Starr. But start independent counsel statute. Independent counsel is short for independent from the Justice Department. So what Ken Starr did and his independent counsel statute probes was he used the FBI to investigate. And of course, the FBI is the investigative portion of the Department of Justice, supposed to be different. Now, we already know that the FBI has been covering this up for over a year before Ken Starr was appointed. So obviously that defeats the purpose of an independent counsel. And he had a total of six, I think, jurisdictions to investigate. One of them was what they call Filegate. That was the illegal use of FBI files to target political opponents. Who did Ken Starr use to investigate that? The FBI. Of course, nothing came out of it. Another one was Travelgate, the illegal use of the FBI to frame Billy Dale, who had was running the travel office. So who did Ken Starr use? The FBI. So if they were to reenact the Ethics in Government Act, just to make it so that the independent counsel would use state prosecutors, state investigators, people who had nothing to do with the federal government, we'd have an independent counsel statute with some real teeth. But that's the last thing that they want in Washington, D.C. There, as I said in that video, which is at the VinceFosterMurder.com, our separate institutions of government are not pursuing different interests. They're all pursuing the same interest, and that is credibility. And that's the last thing they want to happen, is to expose this government corruption.
You know, I'm going to make a parallel for you, what you just said. And I didn't know that. Thank you for bringing this up. That is critically important, that the independent counsel is anything but independent from the justice system. But listen to this. And there are actually two things. I'm going to make a prediction. But in 1977, the House Select Committee on Assassinations convened because of the public pressure not believing the Kennedy Assassination Warren Commission conclusion. And they actually got evidence that showed, from recorded evidence from a police motorcycle's radio that was stuck in the on position and the shots were recorded. They said, oh my gosh, the experts are saying the shots came from two different directions with different guns. Okay. And so then the joint committee ordered the DOJ and the FBI to reopen the investigation. And today, what, 49 years later, they still haven't done it. That's one thing. And it goes to your point about they're not bound by anything. They're tied to the justice system. But I'm going to make a prediction. This Charlie Kirk thing is not going to go away. I've been surprised how quickly the narrative covering up the Charlie Kirk murder has fallen apart. I suspect at some point with public pressure, once the war is over and the attention goes fully back to this, they're going to appoint an independent counsel. And what you just said will show the public why you can't trust an independent counsel without this ethics statute.
Yeah, the Ethics in Government Act. I mean, you would think today that people, everyone would realize that we need the Ethics in Government Act. And it could easily be fixed. All they have to do is say that the independent counsel should use investigators and personnel who are not tied to the federal government and certainly not FBI agents.
I'm going to say something to you that in the audience, I'm going to say, please be patient with me. But John, I've got a background as a therapist, and I taught psychology for decades, from high school all the way to postgraduate in college. I used to teach body language, so I'm saying that as a reference point to have a little credibility in what I'm going to tell you. When I have talked to people from TPUSA who aren't whistleblowers giving me insider information that I should know and can't get anywhere else, when I'm talking to TPUSA openly, okay, and when I watch Erica Kirk get onto certain topics, now this is going to sound bizarre, but the whole body language changes. And I want to see if you see this in Vince Foster's situation. It's like these people get snake eyes, fixated, they get grim, their body language becomes rigid. And I used to teach this. And what I'm really looking at here, it's like a defense mechanism in body language, like I'm preparing for the assault and I'm ready to do battle with you. And you can see it in body language and how they handle their trunk and their limbs. And you can see it in their face. And their eyes become narrow and fixated like they're on, some kind of fight or flight mechanism. Did you find those kinds of traits in people that, let's say, like journalists that wouldn't accept evidence that was overwhelming? Did you see any of those body language giveaways?
Well, I'm not trained to recognize that. I will say in our website, we have a section for the press, and there's a section in there that tells that shows and reflects what it was the journalist said to one of the three of us about the Vince Foster case. When we one of us personally, I'm not just taking this off the broadcast, but one of us, Patrick Knowlton, Hugh Turley, or myself, asked these journalists, what about this? Why don't you cover this? And it is just absolutely amazing what the answers that we got. I asked Cokie Roberts. We would go to gatherings, public gatherings of journalists, and I asked Cokie Roberts. I said, "This is the biggest cover up, one of the biggest cover ups in U.S. history. Don't you think you should at least look into it?" And she said. Said thousands of journalists have looked into it and they have found nothing. Thousands.
That's always their answer. I don't care whether you're talking voter integrity or what the scandal is. That's always the answer you get. It's been thoroughly discredited, but they somehow don't give you thoroughly discredited evidence.
Yeah, there's another quote in there when Hugh Turley asked Helen Thomas, who was a kind of a famous journalist. Showed her the appendix that we talked about, the 20 pages, and she was shocked. She said, "This should be reported to the American people." So a couple of weeks later, Hugh Turley got in touch with her over the phone and said, "You said that this should be reported to the American people." And Helen Thomas said, "This is very unfair of you. I don't do this to me. I have to go," and hung up on him. So, I mean,
Wow.
again. I would commend your viewers to have a look at vincefostermurder.com. And there's also an excellent 30-minute video there that shows everything but the evidence, shows how Patrick Knowlton got involved in this. And
Okay.
it's very, very well done and really describes this harassment that he suffered.
I want to mention this to our audience because some of them might be a little younger. If you go back to your Nightline memories, Ted Koppel, Cokie Roberts was on that show all the time. And so she was a prominent journalist that was front and center in mainstream media. As Nightline was really highly watched at that time. So, yeah, I saw her a lot. And for her to say that, it's so typical of what you see now. But you said something else that triggered something in me. Joe Rogan came out recently after an interview he was doing with oh gosh, I think last name Norman. I forget the first
James Norman.
James Norman. Yeah, he's a comedian. And Joe Rogan, in fact, let me grab my notes here from this because I'm discussing this today. He said with regard to Erica Kirk, he didn't buy the crime scene. Her body language is psycho. That's a quote. That was his quote. I just found this to be so interesting. And then he went on to say she lied about 2013 to 2018 that she was involved in romance and drinking and like who cares, but why lie? And then he questioned all the forensics. He mentioned her CIA ties and he talked about body language with the eyes. And here you got Joe Rogan. And so what does Joe Rogan get? Erica Kirk says, "You better be careful talking about me because you'll lose your podcast." Here's my point. My point is, you've il illustrated this with Vince Foster. It's the same thing. We will make life uncomfortable for you if you tell the truth. You've said it with Brett Kavanaugh. You've said it with this latest person. That's the MO. And so I think the message is this, is when you get resistance like this, you know you're over the target.
I said in that video that we chatted about that is vincefostermurder.com the message that is sent from what happened to Patrick Knowlton, one of the possible messages is that if you know something and the FBI wants you it doesn't comport with what the FBI wants you to say keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. Well, I saw that there was a guy, I don't know if you ever came across Ed Hoffman. He was a deaf mute. who was on the bridge at Dealey Plaza, and he saw the shooters behind the shooter and the spotter behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll, and he went to the FBI, and he was on the Men Who Killed Kennedy 6-part series, and he said the FBI offered him money to go away and said they'd wreck his life if he didn't. And it's the same thing. It doesn't matter, who it is. They do, and look at Jim Garrison, the attorney that brought the only trial for the JFK murder against Clay Shaw. He was vilified, wrecked his legal career. So you're absolutely right about this. So here's my question for you. What kind of pushback have you received over the years?
Very little. Just this was 30 years ago. Now, I've been trying to get the word out for a long, long time. And the only pushback I got is being ignored.
Okay.
Notwithstanding the a mountain of evidence that I have. And when Brett Kavanaugh was being confirmed, I delivered to the committee that was considering his confirmation 80 pages of evidence that of his participation in the cover-up. And I got a call from a staffer. And when the staffer called, I knew that it wasn't going anywhere. She said that, oh, yes, they had distributed to all members of the committee. I knew when it was a staffer that she was lying, and that even if they had distributed this 80 pages to the committee members, if they read it, even if they read it, they would deny ever having seen it. So there are a lot of people inside the Beltway here where I am, inside the Washington Beltway, who know all about this. It's just the American people who don't know about it.
Yeah, well, someone knows about it because we can't get a truly independent counsel at work. And so someone's blocking that process. And not maybe just because of Vince Foster, but I think across the board for now. By the way, do you know who Jim DiEugenio is?
I do not.
Okay. I'm thinking people who are experts in these individual assassinations, like you know more about Vince Foster than anybody I've ever heard talk about. Jim is the modern day expert on JFK. He's one of the few left. And he's really good. He testified before Congress for the release of the CIA files. What needs to happen is the people who are experts in these in common assassinations with the same MOs, they need to form a coalition, compare notes, and go public in the alternative media. I'll see if I can't, get a hold of Jim and maybe put you two in contact, because I think there's validity when we see these assassinations that carry the same MOs and the same kind of cover-ups. I think there's validity in establishing a baseline for the public to look at in one place. I really
Yeah,
do.
I would be all for that. I would be jumping into that with both feet.
It's so, I'll tell you, 30 years I spent on Kennedy, and as a private citizen, just interest, but I came across two novel discoveries. I'll spare the details right now, but I contributed two bodies of knowledge to this during my private time before I was ever doing this kind of work. And then I became friends with Jim Mars. 30 years on this, and nothing has happened. And you know how they hid the evidence with JFK? The CIA files may have been released, but how much can they change after 60 years? But even if that's not true, what we look at, John, is that they disperse the information to other agencies that aren't prone to that executive order. And this is how the CIA is still hiding the JFK facts today. And my frustrating thing is all this work so many people have put in, I feel like I know who fired the fatal headshot. I know how the plot was put together. And yet, nothing ever happens legally. It's like Minnesota Somalia fraud. We got $15 billion of fraud, and the officials involved don't go to jail. It's the same thing. It's one big mafia. Hey, we're out of time, my friend. Quickly, we got about 15 seconds. Tell people how to follow you.
I go to my personal website of my law office is John H. Clark Law. That's JohnHClarke Law, LAW.com. And I would commend the Vince Foster Murder.com It's all there, including the
Okay.
amended complaint, which we haven't talked about, but that's pretty interesting. It reads like a short story.
Now we'll cover that next part next time, but good stuff here. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.